content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the June and July-August 2018 issues of Discover features four stories on permafrost communities, testing of blood, everything worth knowing about clouds, and chemical exposure. Citywide slump, life on shifting ground. Modern human settlements are in peril. Permafrost includes ice that is both pervasive, binding soil components together like glue, and concentrated in thick, pure chunks. When glue-like ice melts, the soil becomes mud, causing gradual sinking and erosion. When ice chunks melt, the overlying ground can suddenly collapse. But buildings can lose structural integrity and become unstable even with modest increases in ground temperature, well before all-out melt. In Alaska alone, the destruction of buildings and infrastructure due to permafrost thaw over the next century could cost more than $2 billion, according to a 2017 study. Regions affected may seem remote and largely uninhabited to outside eyes. But permafrost lands contain settlements ranging from small villages to industrial cities with populations over 100,000. Norilsk, Russia, typifies the urban Arctic. Erected in 1935 as a gulag work camp, Norilsk has grown into a nickel mining and smelting center with 178,800 residents. It's about the size of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, but similarities end there. Norilsk is one of the world's northernmost cities and Russia's most polluted. In December, the sun does not rise and temperatures dip below minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. Like most cities in the Russian Arctic, Norilsk was custom-built for permafrost. The colder the permafrost, the harder or stronger the freezing force that holds foundations, says Dmitry Streletsky, a geographer at George Washington University who studies the effect of permafrost thaw on human habitations. 20th century engineers calculated how much weight foundations could support based on ground temperatures, but those temps have risen by up to 3.6 degrees across Russian permafrost zones in the past three decades. Those designs were not accounting for such a fast pace of climate change, says Streletsky. In his research, Streletsky does that accounting. Instead of temperatures from the time of construction, he subs in current climate data. The result of a study he authored in 2012? Foundations across Siberian cities can bear up to 46% less load in 2010 than in the 1960s, putting them at risk of collapse. In Norilsk, hundreds of residential buildings are visibly deformed because of ground thaw, according to the municipal government's last count in 2015. In other permafrost cities, 10 to 80% of structures are in potentially dangerous states. In some cases, engineers have saved buildings by installing thermosiphons, devices that cool the ground through evaporation and condensation. But those are pretty much point solutions. You have a couple of meters around it where it works, says Streletsky. They can save one building, but they don't save an entire city. While Arctic urbanites grapple with collapsing buildings, traditional coastal villages face total destruction. Over the past five decades, shorelines throughout the Arctic have receded by an average of 1.5 feet annually. Some spots have lost as much as 70 feet in mere hours during violent storms. These Arctic coasts are disappearing due to the combined effects of permafrost thaw, sea level rise, and longer summers when the seas are ice-free. In short, more waves are crashing further onto softer land. This will mean the end for some communities. A report by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers concluded that Kivalime, a native Inupiaq village of 85 homes at the tip of an 8-mile fleck of land in northwest Alaska, will likely be lost to erosion within the next decade. Yet the 374 residents remain. Relocation would cost over $95 million and jeopardize their lifestyle, which depends on hunting and fishing coastal resources. They are tethered to the sea as it consumes their village. In the blood, researchers work to fine-tune a test that could better detect lingering disease in cancer patients. A diagnosis of cancer is scary enough on its own, but cancer cells' ability to hide out in the body after an initial round of treatment is especially insidious. And it isn't possible yet to tell which patients still have any residual disease. Even a few surviving cancer cells can multiply over time, moving out of the original site, the breast or colon, for example, to form a tumor in another part of the body. By the time that new tumor has grown large enough to show up on a CT scan, the cancer is likely incurable. When cancer patients seek treatment, scars from initial therapies like radiation can make detecting new and old tumors difficult. And a traditional biopsy, a tissue sample a pathologist scrutinizes under a microscope for telltale signs of cancer, can be hard to obtain from an internal organ like the lung. For all these reasons, doctors have high hopes for a technology still in its infancy called liquid biopsy, which looks for cancer in bodily fluids. It may identify cancer patients whose disease has persisted past the primary treatment and help home in on effective therapies for them. Liquid biopsy is the result of decades of gene research, which has led to a solid understanding of cancer DNA. Doctors know now that a tumor has its own molecular pattern. It's like a DNA fingerprint, says Scott Kopetz, a specialist in gastrointestinal cancer at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Liquid biopsy can detect the distinctive DNA from cells a tumor sheds into bodily fluids, and it does so quickly. It's also often more perceptive than a CT scan. Blood is the preferred medium for liquid biopsy for now, though eventually other fluids like urine and saliva may come into play for some cancers. But virtually any clinic can do a blood draw, and cancer DNA reliably migrates into the blood, sometimes as fragments, which can be enough for many liquid biopsy tests to read. Jeffrey Oxnard, an oncologist specializing in lung cancer at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, works with liquid biopsy in his practice. We can see evidence of the cancer genome within the patient's free-floating DNA, and we have increasingly sensitive ways of looking for low levels of that cancer DNA, Oxnard says. A major challenge with the technology is developing tests that are sensitive enough to detect even very low concentrations of cancer DNA floating among millions of blood cells. Even with a patient with stage 4 cancer, the tests still can't see the cancer 20 to 30% of the time, Oxnard says. So if a liquid biopsy test comes back negative, physicians must continue to fall back on standard biopsies for their patients. But liquid biopsy is even now pointing the way towards more tolerable treatment for some patients with advanced lung cancer. If patients with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer have specific alternatives in a specific gene, they can get a highly effective oral targeted therapy with few side effects and a dramatic response, Oxnard says. The alternative is chemotherapy, which may be less effective and have more side effects. In a clinical setting, liquid biopsy tests designed to detect one or two genes might now cost hundreds of dollars. Larger panels with more genes can cost several thousand dollars. The next frontier in liquid biopsy will be putting the technology to work identifying patients who have had treatment for some types of early cancer and who seem, based on CT scans, to be cured, but actually still have residual disease. A different type of therapy might give those patients a second chance, says Ben Ho Park, a researcher and clinician at the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore. Because there's no reliable way to tell who still has microscopic cancer cells in their bodies and who doesn't, standard care now often involves simply treating almost everyone with the follow-up therapy. Researchers hope that eventually liquid biopsy tests will identify people with residual cancer, sparing those who have no signs of the disease from unnecessary treatment and leading to more effective treatment for those who need it. Liquid biopsy tests must prove their worth in clinical trials before they can be used as standard care, and those trials can take years. Park is halfway into enrolling 229 patients in a multi-institutional study of women who have triple-negative and HER2-positive cancers, two types in which he can expect at least 20% of patients to be cancer-free after a first round of treatment with chemotherapy. Then, a liquid biopsy test will check for cancer. All patients in the trial will go on to surgery to remove the tissue where the tumor was originally detected. The goal is to prove that liquid biopsy can accurately flag the women who still have cancer, that the disease will then be found in those women, and only those women, during subsequent surgeries. Kopetz of MD Anderson says he too is gearing up to enroll over 1,000 people in a study that will use liquid biopsy to look for residual cancer in patients who have had surgery for early-stage colorectal cancer, but have displayed no evidence of residual disease on CT scans. He anticipates liquid biopsy will detect cancer cells in about 10% of patients, who will then be offered chemotherapy. Another possible future use of liquid biopsy is monitoring ongoing treatment in advanced cancer, alerting physicians to drug resistances developing within patients, and steering them away from therapies that aren't working. Currently, oncologists might treat a tumor for 2 to 3 months and then do another CT scan. If you've guessed wrong, says Park, you just spent 2 or 3 months on worthless therapy. Park also hopes to see liquid biopsy eventually serve as a screening tool to spot early cancer in individuals who don't have a diagnosis, but may have a high risk for developing cancer, such as women with BRCA gene mutations for breast cancer. In addition to attempting to prove liquid biopsy's worth in clinical trials like those Park and Kopetz are conducting, researchers continue to refine their tests to eliminate false negatives as well as false positives that arise from sequencing errors or other factors. One promising liquid biopsy test is the Cancer Personalizing Profile by Deep Sequencing, or CAPP-Seq. In a 2014 study, it identified 100% of patients with advanced lung cancer with few false positives. Max Dean, a radiation oncologist specializing in thoracic cancer at Stanford University, developed CAPP-Seq with colleagues. Dean believes liquid biopsy's potential extends well beyond cancer to such possible applications as detecting infections, Alzheimer's, autoimmune diseases, and the early signs of rejection of transplanted organs. For now, liquid biopsy isn't likely to replace tissue biopsy. There's still a lot of information that comes from looking at a cancer cell under the microscope, says Kopetz. But it does show great promise as a diagnostic and prognostic tool, and researchers are excited. The idea of molecularly investigating a patient's disease status through the blood, I think, will affect many other parts of medicine in the future, Dean says. These tests open possibilities for new, personalized treatment strategies. Everything worth knowing about clouds, sailors of the sky. Drops. That's all there is to clouds. They're made from countless water drops, too small to see with the naked eye. The atmosphere is actually full of these drops, which scientists call water vapor. As the drops rise, they cool and stick to things like dust, ice, sea salt, even pollution, creating clouds. The vapors take on all manner of shapes, and we don't mean hearts or mythical beasts or whatever else people imagine seeing. The American Meteorological Society, official chronicler of clouds, lists 10 cloud genera, 14 species, and 9 varieties. The strangest of these may be Earth's highest, at 250,000 feet or more, thin, wispy, noctilucent clouds, visible only at twilight. Here are the cloud genera. Cirrus clouds. Wispy and thin, these are composed of ice crystals formed from supercooled water droplets. Cirrocumulus. These small puffs cover skies in rows and can look like fish scales, hinting at fair but cold weather. Cirrostratus. Made of ice crystals, these high sheet-like clouds can indicate changing weather. Altocumulus. Fluffy and traveling in groups or bands, altocumulus on a humid morning can mean afternoon thunderstorms. Altostratus. These featureless sheets of vapor and ice, clouds for a meh day, form a gray veil that may mean future precipitation. Nimbostratus. In Latin, nimbus means violent rain, and these moisture-rich dark gray clouds often deliver. Stratocumulus. Earth's most common clouds are puffy and layered, often bringing rain. Their abundance makes them important for modeling climate change. Stratus. These moody clouds include fog and mist. They form when warm, wet air cools, enveloping coasts and mountains. Cumulus. Rising air can make these fair-weather clouds, which have flat bottoms with big cotton ball tops, grow upward into cumulonimbus, thunderstorm clouds. Cumulonimbus. These monsters can tower as high as 60,000 feet, releasing energy as thunder and lightning. Clouds and climate. Clouds cover 70% of Earth's surface at any given time, so they play an important role in shaping climate. As the sun's warming light hits our planet, clouds reflect some of that energy back into space. They also trap some of the energy in the air between them and Earth. So clouds both cool and warm our world. In models, the largest source of uncertainty about how much our climate will change stems from not completely understanding the impact of clouds. Will they slow or quicken warming? Most models predict that changing cloud patterns will add to the warming. One pattern being watched, as tropical dry zones expand, mid-latitude storms push toward the poles. In 2016, research published in Nature looked at cloud observations from the past several decades and found that clouds were indeed shifting poleward as predicted. Anatomy of a supercell. A supercell, an outsized cumulonimbus cloud with a rotating updraft, is extremely dangerous to people, property, and even flying airplanes. Fortunately, supercells are rare, and a classic one is fairly easy for storm watchers to spot, enabling warnings. It's important to avoid its most dangerous areas, the downdraft, where rain, now too heavy to support, brings air back down, and the updraft, where rising air feeds the storm's hallmark rotating core. The downdraft can bring heavy rain and hail. The updraft can spawn tornadoes. A double whammy. Exposure to certain chemicals may be a quiet culprit in the global increase of liver disease. Paul Coder has never been much of a drinker. The retired Marine figures that in 3 decades, his drinks maxed out at 2 beers a year, with a few special occasion celebrations thrown in. "I might have really wahooed it and drank 2 glasses of wine on New Year's," he says. So he was surprised when he was diagnosed in 2010 with stage 4 cirrhosis, the scarring of liver tissue often associated with excessive alcohol consumption. Coder was referred to Matthew Cave, a liver health specialist at the University of Louisville. Cave took Coder on as a patient, but at first it wasn't necessarily clear to him what could have caused the disease. Shortly after, reports started coming out about contaminated water at Camp Lejeune, a Marine Corps base in North Carolina where Coder served in the late 1970s. Now, Cave thinks that exposure probably played a role. While fatty liver disease often results from too much alcohol, it also affects people who don't drink, at an increasing rate. A 2016 study estimated 1 in 4 people globally have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD. Doctors had largely thought that increase was tied to soaring obesity rates, and it is related. But research indicates that certain chemical pollutants may play a role as well. Cave says that in some cases, chemicals by themselves can cause liver disease, but in other cases, they compound the risk already posed by obesity. Liver disease can be hard to detect. There's no easy way to test for it, and it's typically asymptomatic until it's advanced, and at that point, there's no cure. Julianne Beer, a toxicologist also at the University of Louisville, describes liver disease as a spectrum of diseases. Because it's a resilient organ, the first several stages are all reversible. Let's say you're exposed to anything known to cause liver disease, for example, a few drinks in one night. The next day, you will have a fatty liver. But if you stop drinking, it will revert, she says. Eventually, though, the liver loses its ability to revert. That's why the study of liver disease is so important right now, because you can't do anything against it. The liver seems to be more vulnerable when faced with more than one of those risk factors for liver disease. This two-hit theory is not new for the liver. It's been in the scientific literature for over 2 decades. But previous research has mainly focused on factors like obesity and the environment. There didn't seem to be much thought about the possibility that chemicals may also play a role. And to be sure, diet and exercise, as well as genetic susceptibility, are by far the biggest factors in NAFLD. I don't want someone to think that they're feeding their kids chicken nuggets and letting their kids play the Xbox all day, and somehow they have fatty liver because they got exposed to a chemical. By and large, lifestyle is the dictator, says Angela Slitt, a toxicologist at the University of Rhode Island. The question becomes, is chemical exposure a risk factor? Research so far suggests that it is. Exposure to specific chemicals seems to act as a second hit that, combined with obesity, could start the liver down a path where damage may not be reversible. Cave has demonstrated the effect with industrial chemicals, including vinyl chloride and PCBs, which were banned in the 1970s, but don't break down easily and continue to contaminate air, water, and soil around the world. Slitt focuses on fluorinated chemicals, which have been used in everything from carpet treatments to microwave popcorn. Researchers elsewhere are finding that dioxins and other chemicals may also play a role. We've confirmed it a couple of times now that the exposures by themselves really didn't seem like they did a lot of bad things to the liver, says Cave. It was only when the mice were fed a poor diet, a hypercaloric diet, and then got the chemicals that the liver disease got worse. Likewise, he says, a poor diet alone did not cause a more advanced form of liver disease called steatohepatitis in mice, but did so in conjunction with chemicals. Beer and colleagues recently found that vinyl chloride disrupts metabolism and can increase the liver disease risk of a high-fat diet, even at levels below what the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has deemed safe for workers. While most of the research around the two-hit hypothesis has taken place in animal models, Cave and colleagues are attempting to collect the epidemiological research. A community in Alabama has had decades of exposure to PCBs, released by a former Monsanto and now Eastman Chemical-owned facility. The Federal Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry has funded a study on the long-term health effects of those exposures. Cave has a cohort of highly exposed people from an old industrial population, and they're finding very high levels of liver problems, and they're able to also associate those problems, using his animal models, with dietary factors, says Thaddeus Shug, a health science administrator with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, NIEHS, who oversees Cave's work. He seems to be showing that there is a relationship. For the researchers involved, their work is urgent because it affects everyone. Exposure to VOCs, volatile organic compounds, in general, is unavoidable. 100% of the population is exposed to them, says Beer. What she and her team are studying is the role that lower, everyday levels of exposure may play in developing liver disease. Slit recently launched a 5-year study exploring whether different kinds of chemicals can act as unique hits against the liver. And Cave hopes that with a new National Institutes of Health, NIH, program, he is one of 8 scientists chosen to start it. He and colleagues can work to fill in some of the research gaps, such as which other chemicals may have similar effects. Shug says metabolism and obesity have been a research priority across NIH, which is NIEHS's parent agency. NIEHS has also been supportive of research on the exposome, a relatively new field studying the breadth of environmental exposures in a person's lifetime and how those affect health. Cave's work falls right in line both with the exposome and metabolism, and trying to figure out if chemical exposures are leading to the obesity epidemic, leading to the rise in liver problems, says Shug. Coder, the retired Marine, recalls being perplexed when he was first diagnosed with cirrhosis. "I know it wasn't alcohol that gave me cirrhosis, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't southern fried food," he says, while walking his dog one February afternoon. The Department of Veterans Affairs has acknowledged that several water wells on Camp Lejeune were contaminated between 1953 and 1987 with vinyl chloride and other chemicals known to cause health problems, including several types of cancer. Veterans who are based there or at a nearby airbase are eligible for expanded health care benefits. Coder says he was based at Lejeune from July 1976 until January 1978. Cave cannot say for certain that the vinyl chloride exposure is behind Coder's cirrhosis, but it seems a possible culprit. Coder isn't necessarily a picture of health. He has a weakness for fried foods, though not more than the average person, he says. He once ate them without guilt because he felt he was exercising enough to compensate for it. Now he walks his dog 4 times a day and swims and bikes in an effort to keep his weight in check and diabetes under control. But the chemicals at Camp Lejeune may have been another hit on his liver. To Cave, it illustrates the reality of how we live today. Fatty liver is caused by different things that we're all exposed to simultaneously, he says. Today, Coder focuses on doing the best he can to stay on top of his health. He tries not to get hung up on what may have caused the disease. People today, he says, we're just looking for answers all the time that aren't necessarily in black and white. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.